Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 28.
Today, we're zoning in on a really powerful moment for, well, an absolute icon, Sun Wukong, the Monkey King.
From Journey to the West, of course.
Exactly. Of his return to Flower Fruit Mountain, you know, after he's banished by Tang Sanzang.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about loss, big time, change, and the consequences, the real weight of past actions, all hitting him at once. Okay, so he's been kicked out, basically, and he's traveling back. First, he sees the Eastern Sea, and the language is just misty waves stretching endlessly.
Yeah, it really gives you that sense of time past the distance.
It does, but then, bang, he gets to Flower Fruit Mountain, and the contrast is brutal.
Nice.
No flowers, no grass, the mists are gone.
Peaks crumbled, forests scorched. It's total devastation.
And we know why, right? It's the aftermath of his big rebellion against heaven. Erlang Shen and his crew came down hard.
This chapter really shows how, you know, actions ripple outwards. His personal rebellion ends up wrecking his home, his community, the environment. He's forced to see the real cost.
And right then, we get this poem, a lament for the ruined mountain. It feels incredibly raw.
It does. It's like a pause for grief.
He says, looking back at his immortal mountain, tears just stream down. So much sorrow.
He thought it was okay, didn't he?
Yeah, back then I only thought the mountain was unharmed. Today I finally know the earth is damaged, the shock of reality, and then anger flares up.
Directed at Erlang Shen.
Yeah. Hating Erlang for destroying him, blaming Shao Sheng. And then this bit, accusing them of digging up ancestral graves.
Which the text actually implies isn't true, but it shows his state of mind, right? The depth of his hurt and anger.
Yeah.
This violation.
And the poem itself, it's almost like an inventory of loss. It doesn't just say it's ruined.
No, it gets specific. Stone burnt to dust, sand turned to mud. It's methodical.
It really paints a picture of ecological collapse.
Totally. It even goes into, like, the ecosystem being broken. Ilyu, no mulberry trees, so no silkworms. Seijir, not enough willows or bamboo for birds to even nest. Just when it feels totally desolate, a sound.
From the grass slope.
Yeah. And out come these few, maybe 7 or 8, small monkeys, really cautiously.
Wow. Survivors.
And their first words.
Oh, what gets you? Oh.
Grandpa Monkey, you've come home today, just like that.
That simple question holds so much, doesn't it?
Mm.
Relief, maybe hope, years of waiting.
Monkey's surprised, asks why they aren't, you know, playing around like usual, and their answer just opens up this whole other layer of suffering.
What do they say?
They say, basically, ever since he was captured and taken to heaven, life has been unbearable because of hunters.
Mm.
The misery was hard to endure.
Oh, the hunters.
Yeah. Bows, eagles, dogs, nets, snares, just relentless pressure.
So we shift here, don't we, from the destruction caused by heaven to this ongoing, more immediate persecution by humans.
Exactly. And this feels like it's a direct consequence of him not being there. His absence left them vulnerable.
It really lands that theme of responsibility, yeah. Doesn't it? His grand cosmic rebellion had these very real, very painful consequences for his own troop. I mean, the poem focuses on the place, the physical loss,
yeah.
Erlang Shen's actions.
Yeah.
But this encounter, hearing from his own monkeys, it has to bring the personal cost right to the forefront. It's
yeah.
not abstract anymore.
And they describe just trying to survive, or stealing bits of grass to eat, drinking from streams when thirsty, desperate.
You're struggling day to day.
And the numbers, this is staggering. He asks about the others. They tell him they used to be 47,000 strong.
47,000?
So only about 1,000 left.
Oh my God. Where did they all go?
Well, first, many died in the fires Erlang Shen set. Then, with no food or shelter, more died or just scattered.
A cascade of disasters.
And then, just in the last 2 years, the hunters have apparently taken half of the remaining monkeys.
Half?
Yeah.
That's, the vulnerability without him is just stark. Utterly stark.
And the details the monkeys give about what the hunters do, it's chilling.
I can only imagine.
They say, oh, duff, those killed by arrows, spears, poison, they're skinned, boned, cooked up, stewed, steamed, fried, and eaten.
Just consumed, treated like meat.
And the ones captured alive. Their fate is maybe even worse. Force perform tricks, jump through hoops, do flips.
Oh, like circus animals.
Exactly. Paraded in the streets with gongs and drums, completely degraded for human amusement.
Wow. So the grief for the mountain, that sense of loss, now it gets layered with this visceral outrage for what's happening to his actual followers.
Yeah, it's moved from environmental ruin to, like, a humanitarian crisis for his troop. The pain becomes incredibly personal and immediate.
It adds such a powerful emotional weight to his return. He's not just sad about the rocks and trees anymore. He's confronted with the brutal suffering of his family, essentially.
And amid all this, they mention who's still sort of in charge. Some marshals, Saratu and Lu, and the two generals, Ben and Ball.
Ah, some leadership structure remains.
Yeah, and the little monkeys immediately run off to tell them the king is back. Ma, Lu, Ben, and Ba.
And they are just stunned.
I bet. Last they knew, he's off on this huge sacred quest to the west.
Exactly. So their first question is basically, whoa, great sage, why aren't you heading west? What are you doing back here?
Yeah.
It just shows how shocked they are.
So how does he explain it? I imagine he's not too happy.
Oh, he doesn't hold back at all. He lays it out there, says the Tang monk, his master, cannot distinguish good from bad.
Oh.
Yeah. He says the monk kept blaming him for killing demons.
The very things he was supposed to be fighting.
Precisely. The threats he was protecting him from. And then the final insult, this formal letter, it's called basically a dismissal. Banish, you're fired.
Wow. You can just feel the anger, the injustice he must feel punished for doing his job.
Totally. But his monkeys, their reaction is, well, it's pure joy.
Really? They're happy he's back.
Oh, yeah. They're like, great. Forget that, monk. Come back. Stay with us. Let's have fun for a few years.
A proper welcome home party.
They even order coconut wine straight away.
Wow.
But Sun Wukong, his mind's already elsewhere.
Ah, okay. Not ready to relax just yet.
Not even close. Despite this warm welcome, this chance to just, you know, chill.
Yeah.
His first thought is security.
Practical.
Very. He cuts right through the celebration noise and asks, those hunters, when were they last on the mountain?
Hunters. So the mountain's been under attack?
Apparently. General Ma tells him, oh, they're a daily nuisance, a constant problem while he was gone.
So Wukong asks.
He asks, well, why aren't they here today then? And Ma just says, oh, they'll be here soon enough.
Okay, so the tension ramps up immediately. He's barely through the door.
And he's already preparing for a fight. He tells the smaller monkeys to start gathering stones.
Stones? Like just any stone?
No, specifically burnt ones, crumbly ones, and and he wants them piled up. Specific amounts too, like 20 or 30 here, 50 or 60 there. Very organized.
Huh. And does he say why?
Nope. When they ask, he just says, pretty cryptically, they'll be useful to me.
Intriguing, keeping his cards close to his chest.
Yeah, I think it shows his experience, right? He needs control. Keep the plan secret. Make sure orders are followed. Then he tells all the monkeys, get inside the cave, hide, let old Sun work his magic.
Right. Protect the civilians before the battle. Smart.
He's definitely gearing up for a major confrontation.
So the Monkey King goes up the mountain peak, gets a vantage point. What does he see coming?
It is not just a few local guys. It's huge. Over 1,000 people.
1,000.
Yeah. Drums beating, gongs clanging. They've got hunting dogs, eagles on their arms, swords, spears.
Yeah.
It's a proper army, basically, descending on his home.
Wow. No wonder he was concerned. That's an invasion force.
The description in the text is so vivid, it really paints a picture of how serious this threat is. They've got, like, fancy gear, fox fur shawls, brocade belts.
Okay, so they're well-equipped.
And armed to the teeth. Wolf-tooth arrows, fancy-carved bows. The text even compares them to, like, tigers hunting in the mountains, horses leaping over ravines, predatory imagery.
And the gear list itself is something else. You mentioned dogs and eagles, but fire cannons?
Fire cannons.
Yeah.
In wicker baskets. Who brings fire cannons on a hunt?
Seriously.
Gerfalcons. Those are fierce hunting birds. Hundreds of sticky poles, presumably for catching birds. Thousands of rabbit forks, these big ox head blocking nets.
Sounds intense.
And something called, get this, King Yama's not rope.
Yeah.
Yama's the king of hell. Right, so that sounds pretty ominous.
Definitely not your average hunting party. They mean business, and they're noisy.
Yeah. Shouting, hollering, spreading out everywhere. Like scattered stars, the text says. Probably trying to flush animals out, but it's also just loud. Aggressive. A clear statement of intent.
This must be it for the Monkey King. The final straw.
You can imagine. Seeing this horde swarming his home, his territory. Pure fury. So he starts the magic.
Hand gestures.
Yeah, the hand seals, chanting under his breath, no me. Then he turns towards the southeast, the inigi, often linked with wind.
Ah, drawing power from the element.
And takes this huge breath. and unleashes this massive windstorm.
How bad is it?
Catastrophic, basically. Mm. The description is intense. Dust and soil whipped up, trees snapping, huge waves stirred up. If there was water nearby, the sky darkens.
Wow.
And the sound. Pines roaring like tigers, bamboo whistling like dragons, the wind just howling everywhere. And it's already dangerous. Flying sand, rocks. People are getting hurt just by the wind itself.
But then he uses the stones.
Then come the stones. Those piles the monkeys made, he uses this incredible wind to pick them up and hurl them like ammunition.
Oh, man. So it's like a magical bombardment.
Yeah, exactly. And it's brutal. The text is pretty graphic. Stone strikes shatter skulls.
Jeez.
Uh-huh. Flying sand injures the seahorses, meaning their horses are getting hit, too. Just chaos, blood everywhere.
And there's a poem you mentioned.
Yeah, a grim little poem pops up talking about these heroic generals, the hunters, presumably, who couldn't distinguish good from bad, and met this pointless end. It mentions widow's sorrow.
Mm-hmm.
It's harsh.
So from the Monkey King's view, they were invaders who didn't respect his place, and they got what they deserved.
That seems to be the perspective, yeah. They failed to recognize his authority, the sanctity of his mountain.
Mm.
The poem underlines the finality of his counterattack.
Okay, so the wind dies down, the attack is over. What's the Monkey King's reaction?
He comes down, and he's actually laughing. Triumphantly.
After all that.
Yeah. And this is where it gets really, really interesting psychologically. He starts thinking about the Tang monks' teachings, almost mocking them.
How so?
He says something like, 1,000 days of good deeds aren't enough, but 1 day of evil, oh, that has more than enough impact.
Wow. That's cynical.
Extremely. He's basically saying, look, I wiped out these hunters, an evil act, right?
Yeah.
And bam, instant results, problem solved. But all the good I did for the monk, that got me nowhere. In fact, it got me fired.
So he's completely disillusioned with the whole good versus evil thing the monk was teaching.
It looks that way. He sees a direct payoff from his, let's say, decisive action here, whereas his attempts at virtue just led to misunderstanding and dismissal. It's that core conflict, isn't it? His wild nature versus that Buddhist discipline.
And he's not done cleaning up, is he?
Not by a long shot. Practical mode kicks back in. He tells the monkeys, okay, strip the clothes off the dead hunters.
For warmth.
For warmth.
Ugh.
Then dispose of the bodies, toss them in a deep ravine, a bottomless chasm.
Grim, but efficient.
And skin the dead horses for leather, for boots.
Mm.
Salt the meat. Gather up all the weapons, bows, arrows, spears.
For their own use. Training.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And collect all the flags the hunters brought.
Okay, spoils of war. It's not just survival. It's asserting dominance, right? Using the invader stuff.
Totally. It sends a clear message. I'm back, I'm in charge, and this is my stuff now.
And the flags. He does something special with those, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. This is the big symbolic moment. He takes all those captured flags, rips them up.
Rips them up.
And sews them all together into one massive patchwork, multicolored banner.
Okay. And what does he write on it?
He writes his new, or rather reclaimed, statement of purpose. Renovating Flower Fute Mountain, reestablishing the Water Curtain Cave, Great Sage Equaling Heaven.
Great Sage Equaling Heaven. That's his old rebellious title.
Exactly. The one he used when he defied the Jade Emperor, defied heaven itself. He's planting that flag, literally and figuratively. It's a huge declaration of independence.
No more disciple role. He's the king again.
Absolutely. It's unmistakable. He's not just back home. He's fully reclaiming who he was before the journey.
And he gets straight to work rebuilding.
Immediately. Starts attracting his old followers back, demons, beasts, and the whole supernatural crew, stocking up the larders. And significantly, the text notes, he doesn't mention the monk at all.
Like that whole part of his life is just deleted.
Wiped clean. His focus is entirely on Flower Fruit Mountain now. He even goes to the Dragon Kings, the ones who rule the seas, and asks them for sweet rain, magical water, basically to make the mountain flourish again. He plants all sorts of trees, elm, willow, pine, bamboo, fruit trees like peach and plum.
So a total restoration project, bringing life back.
Complete revitalization.
Mm-hmm.
The aim is to return to how things were prosperous, independent, carefree. He is the phrase used, just happy, peaceful, doing their own thing.
Okay, scene change.
So picture this. Tang Monk, Pigsy, Sandy. Monkey King's not around at this point.
Right, important detail.
They've just gotten past the White Tiger Ridge. Now they're deep in this forest.
And the big immediate problem.
Food. Simple as that. They're hungry.
Okay, so let's get into it. The Tang Monk, even with, you know, potential demons and monsters lurking about.
His first thought is his stomach.
Yeah. It kind of shows his dependence, maybe a bit of a naivete, sheltered perhaps.
Could be. And then you have Pigsy stepping up, or seeming to.
Right. He's initially all enthusiasm, tells the monk, hey, wait here, I'll find us something.
And he boasts, doesn't he? That line, sure, yo. Like, I can find food anywhere, even in ice and snow.
Total confidence. But what really happens?
Well, he wanders off, doesn't see any houses, starts thinking, you know, walking's hard work.
Already making excuses.
Pretty much, he decides, forget it. Time for a nap.
Unbelievable. So much for finding food. It really paints a picture of them, doesn't it? That mix of like big talk and, well, laziness.
And self-interest, definitely. Which leads him to that interesting internal thought.
Oh, yeah, about Monkey King.
Right. He thinks, Yoroj. Basically, when Wukong was here, the old monk got whatever he wanted.
Ah, so he's realizing it's not so easy now.
Exactly. Phew, so the oh, she did. And it's like, now it's my turn. And boy, you only know the cost of things when you're in charge. He's actually maybe grudgingly acknowledging Monkey's value.
A little bit of respect there, hidden under the complaints.
Yeah, complaining that it's not fair. Oh, yeah, like, where's the justice? I can't find anything. It shows that Void Monkey left.
And then you have Sandy's reaction when the monk starts worrying because Pixie's taking so long.
Oh, Sandy doesn't pull any punches.
No kidding. His response is just blunt.
Totally. He's basically saying, look, Pigsy knows people out west feed monks often. He's got a huge appetite. Does he care about you? He'll only come back when he's full.
Ouch. So Sandy sees right through him. No illusions there.
None at all. It really highlights the different personalities, you know? The monk's worry, Pigsy's gluttony, Sandy's cynicism.
It's a great contrast. And then the monk's focus shifts slightly, doesn't it?
Yeah, he starts practical. First, it was food, food, food. But with Pigsy gone and night coming.
He says, it's getting late. This isn't a place to stay. We need to find lodging. A bit of realism creeping in.
And that's when Sandy steps up for real.
He takes charge.
Don't worry, Master. You wait here. I'll go find him. Shows his loyalty, his dependability. Someone has to be the responsible one, I guess.
So we've got the Tang monk.
And he's worried. His disciples, you know, Pigsy and Sandy, they've gone off to find food, and he's just
It's
restless.
understandable. So he
Yeah.
figures maybe a little walk will help clear his head, maybe spot his disciples. He gathers his few things, ties up his horse.
And just heads into the woods. But the text is interesting here. It says his troubled thoughts actually lead him the wrong way.
Ah, so it's like his inner state affects his outer journey.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He should be heading west, where Pigsy and Sandy likely went. But he ends up wandering south instead. Lost in thought, lost in the woods.
And then just as the light's fading, he sees something.
Yeah, suddenly this shining pagoda, golden top, catching the last bit of sun. It just appears through the trees.
Now, for the monk, this is huge, right? His whole pilgrimage is about piety, respecting sacred sites.
Absolutely. He has this vow, you see, to stop and pay respects at every temple, every pagoda he finds. Burn incense, pray. It's fundamental to him.
So seeing this pagoda, his first thought isn't, weird place for a pagoda.
No, his first thought is monastery, a place of safety of fellow Buddhists. He just assumes.
And he doesn't even worry about leaving his horse, his luggage.
Nope. Just leaves it tied up, thinks, you know, what could happen out here? It seems deserted. It's that faith, maybe mixed with a bit of, well, wishful thinking, perhaps.
It's understandable, but you just get this feeling, this beautiful thing appearing in these dark woods.
It feels a little too convenient, maybe. A
Right.
little bit like a lure. The text definitely hints that this isn't the sanctuary he thinks it is.
So he gets closer. What's the actual area around this pagoda like? Is it peaceful?
Well, that's the thing. It's bizarre. It's beautiful in a way, but also really unsettling. You've got these massive cliffs, huge mountains stretching out. But the plants are thick, tangled, almost overgrown. And the flowers have these strange, unnatural colors. There are weird details, like rootless clouds reflected in water, fallen trees used as bridges.
That sounds
It
precarious.
does. And even the moss glows, like phosphorescent moss. It's this mix of, you know, striking visuals, but with this undercurrent of danger.
Like nature itself is a bit corrupted there. And it's not just plants, right? There are animals.
Yeah, animals too. But they're moving in and out of a cave entrance in orderly rows, which is odd, not natural.
Suggests some kind of control.
Exactly. The narrator actually calls it an evil tin, an evil place,
Yeah.
straight out. despite how, you know, superficially inviting some of the flowers might look. It's a warning sign.
A warning the monk completely misses, driven by his duty.
He just keeps going, reaches the pagoda door, parts this simple bamboo curtain, expecting, well, monks, I suppose.
And instead?
Instead, bang, he's face to face with this huge, monstrous demon just crashed out of sleep on a stone bed. Total shock.
Oh, wow. And the description, I remember being pretty intense.
It really is. Designed to be jarring. It gives you this indigo face, like deep blue purple, white tusks sticking out, a massive mouth.
Not exactly welcoming.
Not at all. Wild hair at the temples, dyed bright red like rouge.
Yeah.
And this sparse purple beard compared to lychee sprouts. Such a strange detail.
Yeah, that's oddly specific. What else?
A parrot-like nose, eyes like morning stars, probably not twinkling in a friendly way.
Right.
And these huge fists, like the size of monks' alms bowls. And his feet are blue and gnarled. Just a terrifying figure.
And his clothes. Is he dressed like a typical demon?
Sort of. He's got this pale yellow robe on, just kind of thrown over him. But the text says it's more striking than a proper religious robe, a brocade cassock. And he's got a big, gleaming knife right next to him. His pillow is just a smooth stone.
It's the mix of monstrous and mundane that's creepy. Sleeping, having a pillow. But it's him.
Exactly. And he's not just some random monster. The text mentions he commands other, lesser demons. He's got power.
Right, he's a boss demon.
Yeah. And he has these almost supernatural powers, like traveling huge distances instantly. And get this, the description even mentions immortals and Taoists farming jade and making elixirs within his domain.
Wait, really? Immortals in a demon's lair?
It suggests this really weird, twisted hierarchy. It's not just a simple evil place. It's complex, maybe even a perversion of a divine realm. He's even compared to an ox-headed devil, a real figure of dread.
Okay, so the monk sees all this. Understandably, he panics.
Oh, completely. Pure terror. The text says he stumbles back, his body goes numb, legs turn to jelly. Just pure instinct. Run.
But demons in these stories, they tend to have sharp senses, don't they?
This one certainly does, even asleep. His spiritual awareness is incredibly strong. He senses the monk immediately. His eyes just snap open, golden demon eyes, the text calls them. And he instantly barks an order to his minions, go see who's there.
And the report back isn't exactly subtle, is it?
No. A little demon peeks out and gets all excited. Describes the monk as, like, plump, round-faced, with tender skin and delicate flesh. Calls him a fine monk.
Which, coming from a demon...
Which looks delicious.
Yeah, it's sinister praise.
And the big demon's reaction? He buys it.
Totally. He laughs out loud, basically says, perfect, lunch just flew into my mouth.
He sees the monk as easy prey. Delivered right to his doorstep.
So he tells his underlings to grab him?
Yep, go get him. Rewards for everyone. And they just swarm the poor monk.
It sounds like chaos. Can he even try to escape?
He tries. His heart's pounding. He's scrambling. But he's terrified, exhausted. And the forest floor there is treacherous. It's hopeless.
He's completely out of his element.
Exactly. The story uses that proverb. A dragon in shallow water gets mocked by shrimp. A tiger on flat plains gets bullied by dogs. He's powerful in his own way, spiritually, but here, physically, he's helpless.
So they catch him, drag him back to the boss.
Right. And the big demon looks him over. And interestingly, he notices the monk's dignity, his bearing, even captured like this. He thinks, huh, this guy looks important, maybe someone from the heavens.
A brief moment of hope. Maybe he won't eat him.
It's a fleeting thought for the demon, based on appearance. But it doesn't last.
He goes into intimidation mode.
Full-on monster display. Bristling beard, hair standing on end, bulging eyes, lets out this huge roar. Just pure assertion of power, trying to break the monk's spirit.
Terrifying. And the monk.
He's forced inside, completely cowed. He manages a sort of terrified, forced, polite greeting. And then the demon starts questioning him.
Who are you? Where are you going? That kind of thing.
Exactly. Wants the details.
Don't worry.
The standard villain interrogation.
And the monk, being who he is, just tells the truth.
Yep. Completely honest. Explains he's from the Tang Empire on a mission from the emperor to get scriptures from the West. Says he saw the pagoda and just wanted to pay respects, asks for forgiveness, hopes his name will be known when he returns successfully.
Still clinging to his mission, even now. You'd think that might earn some respect.
From this guy. Not a chance. The demon just bursts out laughing, mocks him, says he knew he was someone important from the capital, and basically perfect timing. You walked right into my larder. You were destined to be eaten.
Wow. Just lays it out there. No ambiguity.
None at all. Super chilling. And then he gives the order.
To tie him up?
Right. Tells the little demons to bind him, and they tie him really tightly to something called a soul-stabilizing stake. just emphasizes his utter helplessness.
Grim. But the demon's not done questioning him yet.
No, his greed hasn't peaked. He asks, are you alone? Any companions?
Uh-oh. Does the monk tell him?
He does. Maybe hoping it'll change things. Or maybe just too honest or scared to lie. He says, yes, he has two disciples, Pigsy and Sandy, and they're out baking for food right now.
Does he say where the horse and luggage are, too?
Yeah, he mentions they're back in the woods where he left them. Spills all the beans.
Oh, San Zhang. And the demon must be thrilled.
Absolutely ecstatic. Rubs his hands together, basically. Wonderful luck. Two more, plus the horse. That makes four. Enough for a really good meal.
He wants the whole party. So does he send his minions out hunting immediately?
You'd think so, right?
Yeah.
But no. He actually makes a surprisingly smart strategic move.
Really? What does he do?
He tells them to bolt the main gate securely. Shut everything up tight.
Why?
His thinking is, the disciples will come back, find the monk gone, track him here eventually. Why go hunting when the prey will come right to your door? He even uses a proverb, business that comes to your door is easy to do.
Wow. That's disturbingly practical. Cunning, even.
It really is. So he decides to just wait. Let Pigsy and Sandy walk right into the trap.
So that's where we leave the monk, tied to a stake, knowing his disciples are heading straight for this demon who's planning to eat them all.
That's the cliffhanger. An absolutely terrifying situation. That simple walk turned into a nightmare. It just hammers home how danger can appear so suddenly where you least expect it.
And that beautiful pagoda, that symbol of hope, turned out to be a complete facade.
Exactly. It really makes you think about appearances, doesn't it? How easily we can be deceived by what looks safe or familiar. The monk saw a pagoda and assumed safety, piety. The reality was monstrous.
Okay, scene change.
His disciples, Shaseng and Zubaji, they were off doing something else, and now, boom, master's gone. And what hits you straight away is how differently they react. I mean, really different.
Oh, totally. Shaseng is just like instant panic mode. He goes looking for Zubaji and finds him, not getting food like he was supposed to, but fast asleep, mumbling nonsense.
It really sets them up, doesn't it? Shaseng's like, hey, master sent you for food. You're sleeping. You can hear the worry, the responsibility, maybe even a bit of frustration with Baji. And Baji, he just wakes up all groggy. Ah, brother, what time is it? Like, completely clueless. It hints at his nature, maybe a bit too focused on his own comfort.
Right. And then when the reality hits, master's missing their reactions, just drive that home. Shaseng immediately thinks, oh no, a demon got him, and maybe blames Baji a little for slacking off. But Zubaji, he paints this picture of the master just, you know, wandering off, maybe found a nice village. He even imagines this treasure pagoda, shining light, thinking about a meal. It's almost funny, given how dangerous their trip usually is.
Yeah, that optimism from Baji.
Yeah.
Like genuine cluelessness.
Hmm.
Or maybe just his way of dealing, pushing away the scary stuff with thoughts of food. Shaseng, though, he's grounded. He knows demons around every corner. That contrast is really key here.
But Shaseng's caution wins out, thankfully. He insists they check out that light Baji saw. And what they find, it totally bursts Baji's bubble. No nice temple. Just this closed gate and the stone tablet. It says, Bowl Mountain, Wave Moon Cave. Ominous, right?
Very ominous. That's the moment things get real. Shaseng gets it immediately. Brother, this isn't good. It's a demon's cave. You know, Wave Moon Cave sounds kind of poetic, but that just makes the reality a demon's lair on Bowl Mountain even more sinister. And the gate being shut tight confirms it.
Yeah, you can almost feel Shaseng thinking, okay, this is bad. Master's probably in there. But Zubaji, his reaction is so Baji. He seems more annoyed the door is locked than actually scared. He just starts hammering on it, yelling, open up, open up.
Classic Baji. Acts first, thinks later, just demands entry. Which, of course, immediately tells whoever's inside that they've got company.
So much for surprise. And the reaction from inside is interesting. This little demon gets all flustered by the noise. His description of them is great, too. The long mouth, big-eared monk and the inauspicious-looking one. Classic. He runs to tell his king. Now, the old demon, the king, his reaction is weirdly pleased. Like, huh, they actually found me. How'd they find my door? That's pretty much the quote, right? It's intriguing, isn't it? That mix of surprise and delight. Maybe he knows their reputation, or maybe he just wasn't expecting them quite so soon. But then he immediately calls for his armor and weapon. So whatever his initial reaction, he's not messing around. He's getting ready. And then he comes out, and wow, the description they give us, it's something else. We're talking like blue face, red beard, hair like fire, golden armor, specific details about the belt, the sash, a girdle, and a sash. And his hands holding this knife, the soul reaping knife. His hands are described as blue and tough looking, seriously imposing.
Oh yeah, every detail just screams power and danger, fiery hair, soul reaping knife. It builds this really menacing image. And oh, get his title, the Yellow Robe Demon. Yellow's often a powerful color, symbolically. And Old Monster, combined with that, suggests he's been around, maybe has some serious status in the demon world.
Definitely. And he doesn't waste time. Straight up asks, who are you? Why are you making noise at my door? And Baji's response, oh man. He claims to be the demon's father, demands Tang San Zhang back, threatens him with the rake, the sheer nerve.
It's peak Zhu Baji, isn't it? All bluster and, frankly, foolishness. Trying to intimidate this obviously powerful demon is more likely to just annoy him, you know? But yeah, threatening him with the rake, that's Baji saying, okay, let's go.
Okay, but here's where it gets wild. The yellow robe demon plays along, mockingly says, oh yeah, I got him, fed him human meat buns, want some. And Zhu Baji, for a second, seems to actually fall for it. He's ready to believe it. Shai Seng has to jump in, like, brother, seriously, he's messing with you. Since when do you eat human meat? It just perfectly shows how different they are.
Exactly. Baji's gullibility there.
Yeah.
Wow. He just doesn't think critically sometimes, especially when someone sounds like they're in charge, even a monster.
Yeah.
Shai Seng's logic cuts right through it. When have you ever eaten that? He's the grounded one, the perceptive one. A small moment, but tells you so much.
And that's the trigger. Baji realizes he's been played, no more talk, pulls out that nine-toothed rake, and just goes for the demon. And the fight is on end.
Yeah, it kicks off immediately. The demon parries with his own weapon, his steel Dao.
Mm-hmm.
Skillful defense. And then, interestingly, they take the fight up into the air, into the clouds. Why do you think that happens? As drama.
Oh, absolutely amps up the drama, makes it clear this isn't just some street brawl. These are powerful beings. And Shai Seng sees how serious it is. He makes that call, drops the luggage, leaves the horse, and joins in with his own staff. Total loyalty.
Right, dropping the baggage shows you everything else is secondary now. It's all about the master. And the description of that three-way fight, it's incredible. Very emo. Staff rises, sword meets it, rake comes, knife parries. It talks about the demon showing his power, the monks revealing their divine nature. The rake is heroic, the staff is fierce. Just amazing imagery.
It really is. You get the sense of chaos, power clashing, swirling clouds, the ground shaking. And you know why they're fighting. The demon's defending his prize, his turf, the monks. Pure loyalty, fighting for their master. But even after, what, dozens of rounds, the text says, no one's winning. It's just this brutal, evenly matched stalemate, life and death stuff.
That stalemate really tells you how tough this yellow robe demon is. He's not just some random monster they could easily beat. He's a serious problem. Which leaves Tang San Zhang still stuck in that cave in terrible danger. The stakes just got much, much higher.